Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and Jake McClure. We did that really well.
You're very proud that we can say our names.
Yes. I've been practicing.
Difficult.
You know, it's something I've been practicing a long time.
It's nice to get it right occasionally.
It is. And the Personal Wealth Coach is not only a radio program to which you may listen on Saturday morning. And by the way, this is Saturday, September 13th. This is an unusual month. Well, actually, it's a common month, but Friday the 13th fell on Saturday this month. And it is the beginning of fall unofficially because it got cool last night. Anyway, the Personal Wealth Coach is also an investment advisory firm registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission to provide investment advice. In our particular case, we do something called wealth management, and we study economies and things like that. And that's the kind of thing we like to talk about, and that's the kind of thing we like to ask questions about, answer questions about. We generally have more questions than we have answers, which is good. And if you would like to call into this radio program, and again, presuming this is Saturday the 13th of September, the year of our Lord 2014, then you're welcome to do so. And the telephone numbers, if you're in East Bell County, is 773-1400. And anywhere else that you happen to be able to hear us in the United States, the telephone number is
1-866-597-1400.
Okay, now we got everything out of the way.
Yep.
We've got our official disclosures out of the way.
We've said who we were.
Yes.
We've said the telephone numbers.
Yeah.
Okay, we're done.
So it's your turn now. I don't see the telephone board lighting.
Well, we have not been live and on the air for...
I have been live.
But on the air, live.
Right.
For several weeks.
Right.
We have not been dead, but we haven't been on the road or on the air during this. I went to New Mexico, and you went to Colorado,
yeah.
And so coming back here, the last day we were on the air, I said something about a volcano in Iceland. And I said it could be very bad, it could be big deal, but that it has the potential of being really nasty.
So you were talking about a potential eruption.
Right. Well, it's erupting now, and it's been erupting for several weeks. But it's erupting in a kind of best-case scenario, except that there's another problem. And let me kind of lay some background here. This is the largest volcanic system in Iceland, and it is massive. And if it were to erupt on a full scale, we haven't seen anything like that since people have been living in Iceland. A scale of about 1/4 of what this could be basically wiped out all of Iceland and most of...
You're still being alarmist
here. It's pretty nasty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this eruption's going on. It's kind of a long trench that has a curtain of lava that's shooting straight up in the air about 100 meters. It's really pretty.
I was looking at it from space.
Yes, it's very pretty. The volcano is called Bartharbunga. And
man, if you're going to have a volcano, that's a good name because you can pronounce it.
It's just fun to say. If you're Icelandic, thank you, Iceland, because this is one we know how to say.
Yeah, that last one was...
Too many syllables, consonants, and vowels. So anyway, one more piece of information about this. The danger's not past just because it's not in the news very much anymore. The glacier on top of Bartharbunga, which is the biggest glacier in Europe, has dropped 60 feet in the past week. The crater is actually dropping. This is not a good sign. I mean, it could, again, not be that big a deal later on, but if it continues to do this, it means that there's going to be a very large eruption.
So if you happen to be over Iceland right now...
Don't go there right now. Bad place to be.
There's a risk. Okay.
Yeah.
We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hi. Just two things. One, a suggestion. I'd listen to one of your reruns last 2 weeks, and you were having problems with the board. I was wondering if you ever thought about taking a picture of it with the settings that you like. So if you come in and something's not working right, you can reset all the switches.
That would be nice. It really would be nice.
Did we just take too long?
And there's another side of this. Sometimes they have new inputs going to different knobs and dials, which is what we mean when they when we say they surprise us. Because sometimes there's switches that have a satellite input going to one dial, and they have switched it to be that way because later in the day or earlier in the day, that satellite feed was there. So if we go to move that dial, it doesn't do the same thing as it did before.
Going through, I know where the switches are supposed to be. It's just there's so many switches, and there's so many possible positions for those switches that in the time between the last radio program and the end of the news, which is... It's 5 minutes, but it takes them about a minute to get out of here. So we have 4 minutes to get in, get all our equipment set up, and get everything turned on. And if everything is just right, if all the switches are set just right, we can do it as we did today... Bingo, the music starts.
Yeah, be careful about it. We could have missed something and we'll have some tones
today,
or something.
The music started just as the news ended. Let me tell you, we were in a flurry of activity until the moment that music started. And once the music starts, then I go around and start turning up the microphones and setting everything that I know is likely to be out of position. But there's probably 150 or 200 possible switches thrown in possible positions in here, in addition to those that we mess with. So it's an interesting, you know, what's that thing you go to and you play with your computer and you get smarter that they're advertising all the time that's good for your brain?
It's not really good for your brain. But
it's supposedly good for your brain. It's sort of like that exercise, you know. It's like we got hundreds of possible positions and
you should talk to your daughter about that commercial. She doesn't have an aneurysm right there, it's a neuroscientist.
I also have a question for you.
Okay, sure.
I think it was been probably at least a couple of months ago, but you were talking about a new effort in Congress to regulate the Federal Reserve that you did not approve of, and I was just wondering what the status was of those efforts. Did they succeed or not succeed?
It's largely fizzled.
It's on hold at this point.
Thank you for calling.
Just like almost every other thing in legislation at the moment, everything's on hold until November.
There is a generally accepted principle that the act of Congress politicizing the Federal Reserve would be an utter disaster to the economy. And one of the reasons that I know that the people in Congress are not quite as crazy as they collectively appear to be is that this never gets out of a hearing where particularly the more right wing and libertarian congressmen.
Well, at this point in the cycle,
make a lot of noise about it.
When there is a Republican Senate and a Democrat House, it tends to be the other way around. It gets to the more left wing are not happy with a corporation running, you know, a group of corporations running the Federal Reserve, basically. And it switches back and forth between who's in charge at the time.
The extremists on both sides of the political spectrum would like to do away with the Federal Reserve and give all the power and money that the Federal Reserve has to Congress. If you think about the fact that Congress is in the business of spending more money than they have.
Right.
And I say that because they've been doing it a really long time. And directing a lot of it towards their local district or state. Mitch McConnell's in a apparently a very tight race, for example, for his Senate seat this year.
Right.
And his primary campaign position is, I have brought you a lot of bacon. And and if you think about the fact that the Federal Reserve has in its coffers probably the largest bacon collection in the world, and is capable of distributing bacon to just about anybody they want. Now, if they dumped all that money into the system without concern and just spent it on road projects and everything else, we'd have runaway inflation.
It's happened before.
But we want to try to avoid that whenever possible. We had a caller on 773-1400, and they obviously ran out of patience with us. But if you call back, we'll put you on the air. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number's in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And caller on 773-1400, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I enjoyed the show as usual. I have a question about the Fed again. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal that they had put a board together, I guess, of Fed members.
Whoa, you are on top of it.
Yeah.
To keep the ear to the rail and look for bubbles. Is this the that's common sense to me, but is this the first time they've done that? If not, why? And if they have, how come they missed the housing bubble that started all this financial mess?
You always ask complicated questions.
Well, it's not really a complicated question.
This is a long list.
I'm going to hang up and listen.
Okay.
I've been on I-35.
Okay. Ooh, dangerous.
One of the fascinating things about the Federal Reserve is that Congress keeps passing new acts and giving them more responsibilities that they didn't have before.
Mm-hmm.
The newest set of responsibilities is to look for bubbles in the economy, the market and the economy. This is actually kind of counter to what their other objectives are. The objectives of the Federal Reserve from the beginning have been to protect the buying power of the currency. So we don't want high inflation. We don't want high deflation. There's a kind of a sweet point, and the job of the Federal Reserve is try to keep it there. Sometimes that means that it's a good idea to have a recession. If we've got runaway inflation and you raise interest rates above the inflation point, you get a recession. This happened at several points. George H.W. Bush probably lost his election because Alan Greenspan decided to raise interest rates at a time when it wasn't most advantageous for the political scene. So keeping that in mind, the politics of it, recently after the 2008-2009 downturn, Congress passed a series of things that said that the Federal Reserve was also now in charge of looking for bubbles. So keeping in mind that...
I've done that in my life.
Right, I've looked for bubbles. There's a bubble right
bubble,
there. There's a bubble.
Yeah.
Keeping that, the primary purpose used to be very easy to say about the Federal Reserve. Primary purpose of the Federal Reserve was to protect the buying power of the U.S. dollar. Now the primary purpose of the Federal Reserve is four or five-fold, which is really hard to have a primary purpose that's actually four purposes.
They also had the, right from the beginning, the business of protecting the banking industry.
Correct.
And they asked for more. And Congress ultimately gave them the FDIC because they
said,
look,
falls in your bally work anyway.
Really, you know, we can regulate the banking industry, but as we noted in the 1930s, banks tend to fail if they don't have a federal insurance agency standing behind them and regulating them. So they've been doing that. The Federal Reserve, it is a critical point of economics that our nation debated on.
It still debates on.
Seriously debated on for the first century and a half that we existed.
Right.
And that's whether or not we need a central bank. Jefferson
was very much against it.
Right. Jefferson was also against corporations, by the way.
Yes, he was.
I mean, the Constitution is a prohibited activity.
Right. You're not allowed to have corporations.
Right. And
that doesn't work very well.
It doesn't. But you know, Jackson abolished the Second Bank of the United States, and Congress, he ignored Congress to do so, by the way.
And Jackson, when we talk about Jackson, this is Andrew Jackson. We're talking about the 1800s. Andrew Jackson, early 1800s,
mm-hmm.
abolished the Second National Bank, which is the equivalent of the Federal Reserve today.
Mm-hmm.
The National Bank, the thing that was protecting the buying power of the dollar.
And the stability of the banking system, and as a result, we had a banking collapse, runaway inflation, and the Civil War.
Right. Exactly.
Runaway inflation, a depression, and the Civil War. And all of those can be traced
very directly
to Andrew Jackson's decision
using
Martin Van Buren as his Secretary of the Treasury to remove all the reserves from the Federal Reserve and give it to the people, the banks, that had supported him in his run for Congress,
right.
In his run for president.
The pet banks of the Western frontier, which were just next to the Louisiana Purchase, because we hadn't done that part yet.
Purchased Louisiana, and then he started selling off the land in Louisiana, which caused people to buy land they'd never seen and
we had
swap it around, land speculation.
Real estate bubble, okay.
Yeah, does that sound familiar?
Exactly. I mean, basically, there's a scenario that's very similar to what we've just gone through. in that we had a speculative real estate bubble where people were buying land that they didn't know what to do with so that they could With borrowed money so that they could sell it again later at a higher price for the next person that came along that wanted to do exactly what they just done.
Right, and they'd never seen it.
So what we did this time around is we said we need more regulation of the banks. We need to make sure that the central bank has the ability to tell banks that they need to keep more reserves. What they did last time around, well, not last time around, but the Jackson time around, is they said, well, the federal bank, the second bank of the United States, wasn't doing its job, so let's just get rid of it and give all this money to all these little banks. Well, that caused the bubble that we were seeing in real estate at that point to magnify to a level that has not since been seen.
Actually, Andrew Biddle, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit here.
Okay.
Andrew Biddle, who was the chairman of the Second Bank of the United States, the Alan Greenspan of his day,
right,
objected to Andrew Jackson's doing something or another, and I don't even remember what it was at the time, and Andrew Jackson decided that he wanted rid of Andrew Biddle and the bank to begin with, because Andrew Jackson, although he was the first Democrat president, was somewhat to the right of where the Tea Party is today.
Yeah.
I say somewhat,
several
orders of magnitude to the right.
Miles.
To the point where when the Supreme Court ruled against him, he's famous for saying, how many regiments does John Jay have?
Right, John Jay being the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
What the caller asked about was the Financial Stability Committee, because one of the things that Dodd-Frank, the bill that addressed the collapse that we had, which probably needs to be completely wiped off the books and rewritten.
Yeah, it needs to be written in a non-political...
Because it's...
It needs to be bipartisan.
For example, and let me rabbit trail here just a little bit.
All right.
There's several major... credit organizations, Ford Motor Credit and others, who have issued bonds based on their car loans and things like that. And Dodd-Frank says each issue must be rated by a major security agency like Standard & Poor's. Well, the same bill, Dodd-Frank, states that if Standard & Poor's rates the credit worthiness of a issuance like Ford Motor Credit's bonds, it takes personal responsibility for a percentage of the possible losses that an investor might incur in those bonds, which sounds like a really brilliant idea, because obviously S&P and others were getting paid, Moody's and so on, were getting paid to rate bonds at a certain level, and they took the word pretty much of the people who were paying them, and so they rated some bonds that were garbage as AAA. They made a mistake, big mistake. And yet they don't bear any personal responsibility for that. Well, so Dodd-Frank says, okay, you're going to bear personal responsibility for that in the future. Well, the problem is Ford Motor Credit has got to issue these bonds because they've made the loans, and they already had the bonds outstanding.
Right.
And no credit agency would rate them because they didn't want to take the responsibility for whether people paid off their car loans. That's Ford Motor Credit's job. And as a result, the law very clearly states that all of those securities out there are now illegal securities. However, no one is enforcing it because it would collapse the financial system if they shut down, if somehow the government went in, the SEC or whoever is supposed to do that, and nobody... by the way, in the law said who was supposed to enforce this, were to go in and shut down all of those bonds across the world and say they're worthless because they're illegal.
Right.
And as a result, there's just a tacit understanding that large portions of Dodd-Frank are to be ignored. So when you get a law that's passed by Congress and large portions of the economy simply say that law is not workable, we're going to ignore it, that's about as effective as a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit.
Yeah.
And it breeds contempt for the law. So that thing needs to be torn out and done over again, but nobody wants to do it that way.
It was hard to get passed to begin with, and that was at a time when everybody was really aware of the dangers of the system, and people are starting to get a little bit more rosy-colored glasses about what the system does and what the dangers are and say, oh, that could only happen once in our lifetime type situation.
Well, it's a situation that won't work, and the law needs to be redone. But then the Federal Reserve created a Financial Stability Committee because Dodd-Frank gave the Federal Reserve responsibility, get this one now, for any institutions in the United States that were large enough to potentially create financial instability.
Yeah.
The too big to fail companies.
Yeah, these too big to fail companies are now being regulated by the Federal Reserve, this new board. Now, here's the deal. There's no criteria set in the rule book of what too big to fail means.
Nobody really knows what it means.
So this board has to look at corporations when they get to a certain size and say, if this corporation were to fail, what would it do to the United States? So if you think back to what happened with General Motors, where there was kind of a waffling back and forth, and the Obama administration said, well, if it fails, then all of its parts suppliers will fail, and if all of its parts suppliers fail, then we're going to go really deep into this recession, maybe a depression. How will we ever recover? That's the kind of conversation that's going to be going on at these meetings of
and at the Treasury, by the way, because they're also tasked with the same thing. They have an Office of Financial Stability Policy.
Nothing like having multiple people in charge of the same thing.
And by the way, Stanley Fischer is the chairman of the Federal Reserve Financial Stability Board, a really, really smart guy, and a great irony here. His previous job was the chairman of the Central Bank of Israel.
And this guy is amazing, actually. He's a Nobel Prize winner and pretty fantastically brilliant person. But if you think about having a governmental department with a political cabinet appointee at the head being in charge of doing the same thing that an apolitical group, supposedly, the Federal Reserve, mm-hmm. we want to keep it as apolitical mm-hmm. as possible, is in charge of doing.
But that's part of our system. the Founding Fathers, matter of fact, I made a comment in a Wall Street, I very rarely make comments on Wall Street Journal articles in the Wall Street Journal, but I did today. The United States is in an interesting position right now, and I realize I sounded like I just ran off in another direction. Our founding fathers, if you read the preamble to the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
we are doing it. We are creating a more stable and more beneficial system. And they put this thing together in a patch it together. Thank God that Great Britain was about to reinvade us.
Right.
Because in the face of a threat, it's amazing what people can do effectively that they can't do if nobody's threatening them. We have created this hodgepodge of government that is so counterintuitive, inefficient, and
that's what checks and balances are all about.
And opposed to each other, and so you got two different agencies that are trying to do the same thing, that are not under the same person, that have different priorities, and they're going to be fighting each other all the way down the line.
This I realize it's
and
still...
then, you know, there's also a congressional committee. That does the same thing.
Right. So, just to give another, quick snippet of what's going on elsewhere, we talk about the concept of fiduciary, and that's a standard that's put forth by the Securities Exchange Commission.
Well, one standard.
One standard.
The Labor Department has another one.
Well, the Labor Department,
right.
And they're arguing back and forth, and this debate has been going on, and Congress keeps stepping in to mediate the debate to figure out what is the right standard for fiduciary? The same thing's going on at the Federal Reserve and Congress and Treasury and every other aspect of the government when it comes to finance. When we're talking about a concept rather than a physical thing, it's really hard to regulate because everybody has a different opinion.
That's the insanity and the beauty of our government. There's people who are concerned about the government conspiracy to take over things.
Yeah,
no, they can't
conspire against themselves properly.
Our founding fathers put a government together that was so disconnected, discombobulated, inefficient, and dysfunctional
that it actually works.
Yes. Okay. So we have another caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
With y'all being Scottish and all, I was just wondering if you had an opinion on the Scottish referendum And if so, you know, does that give credence to anybody else that wants to peacefully resolve from the union that they're currently in?
All right. Well,
I can.
There's all kinds of stuff to start with here.
Them Scots is crazy.
Okay. From the beginning, let's kind of go back and say, all right, the British Empire at one point covered a much larger area than it does today. And they made the decision sometime after some colonials revolted and had a couple of wars with them that when people wanted to leave their country, they weren't going to fight them over it. That they would just have to have an election in place and that would be it. We made kind of an opposite decision when secession happened in the United States. The United States seceded from Great Britain, and that was fine, but the United States can't secede from itself. That's not fine.
Well, actually can. Congress can authorize a state to leave if the president signs the bill.
Right. Well, the president has to sign the bill.
Yeah, and Congress and the president have to agree that they want rid of a given state.
And I think there needs to be a supermajority on that. I think it's the same as a violation of a treaty. It's a big deal. It's ratification and all kinds of...
No, I think it's a simple... The Congress can simply pass a law telling a state goodbye.
Okay. Well, in the case of Great Britain... What's happened with India? India's a great example. They were toying with the idea of not allowing India to leave. You know, Gandhi's movement was...
But India was just a colony, though.
Well, India's just a colony, and it's not... Well, it was part of the Commonwealth, though.
Which still is.
And this whole thing back and forth. Now, with Scotland, it's kind of testing the resolve of the British... conglomerate. I don't even know what to call it.
It's called the United Kingdom, yeah. It's England, Wales, Northern Ireland, and Scotland.
Scotland's vote has historical precedent. It would be okay. It would give the Castilians in Spain a reason to vote, and the Basques, and so on. So what we're looking at is destabilization of country borders. Well, that's happening in Ukraine and in Georgia already, so why is that a big deal? What is it, as far as our opinion about the specifics of, is it a smart idea for Scotland to do that? You summed it up very nicely. That
them Scots is crazy.
Ach, lad, what's your doing? You need to put that away and go back to doing your business.
The point is that Scotland financially... almost certainly will be devastated
financially
and economically. And there's not a lot of people, relatively speaking, that live in Scotland now, and there'll be a lot less if they decide to leave England, because
there's a nice list of financial institutions and oil companies that have to leave Scotland in order to keep their corporate identity.
And the point is, the Scots... The main argument...
Let me say the top one on the list. You'll like this. The top corporation on the list that has to leave Scotland if Scotland's no longer part of the United Kingdom is the Royal Bank of Scotland.
Yes. And they won't have any currency.
Right. It's because the laws that they're incorporated under are British laws, not Scottish laws. They can't have their headquarters in a country that's no longer part of the country that they are incorporated under.
If Scotland leaves, I mean, it's a great romantic thing. It's about as effective as Texas leaving the United States, which, by the way, would devastate Texas.
And the United States would feel it as well. It would be painful for the United States, but Texas would be devastated.
And it would create significant instability. For starters, if Scotland leaves, from Scotland's perspective, if Scotland leaves, secedes.
Right.
And by the way, it's just a referendum. But both Parliament and the Prime Minister have said they will honor the referendum. Okay.
Right.
So if they leave, they're no longer a member of the European Union. Well, the argument that's being made, one of the arguments that's being made by, I can't remember the name, who's the head of the Scotland Independent Movement, is that they would just keep using the British pound. Well, the
Brits don't like that very much.
The Chancellor of the Exchequer said, well, you're welcome to try, but we're not going to support it. And the European Union said, well, then if you're using the British pound, if you're using someone else's currency, you can't join the European Union.
Right, that's part of the rules.
And this is the point. Scotland is a net recipient of money from the European Union. And all of a sudden they would have tariffs to trade with Europe.
All of Europe.
And
the United States.
They would have visas. Now, this is really weird. You want to go into deep weirdness here. They would have to get a visa from England to travel into England. They'd have to get visas. In other words, they have no relationship with other nations. And it's all based on something that is really dangerous, and that is the price of oil.
Yeah.
And they have all this, all these oil rigs setting off the coast of Scotland, and they don't get all of the revenue from the oil rigs. You know, it's kind of like in Alaska, the revenue from the oil, a lot of it is allocated directly to the people of Alaska,
right,
so that they basically get a big, in effect, tax return every year without paying taxes.
Yeah, the ratio to of tax income is something like, and I have to relook at this, but the last time I looked, it was something like 80% of the revenue going to the government of Alaska came from oil companies.
Well, the problem with that is England has already said, no, those are our oil rigs, and that's our territory.
Right. They're not giving up that territory.
And they're not giving up the territory in the North Sea, and they're not giving up the oil rigs, and they have precedent to it. And, you know, Scotland does not have an army, a navy, or an air force to challenge England.
Right.
And they will suddenly discover they have to pay for one. Anyway, we have another caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Jeff, I apologize if you discussed this previously, but can you briefly, hopefully, describe the export-import bank and what the issues are as far as...
Oh, yeah.
Of that. Thank you.
Sure.
I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah.
Okay.
We've got some commercials to play too, so you want to hit this?
The Export Import Bank, the aspect of it that the Republicans in the House of Representatives want to do away with, and apparently the Republicans in the Senate do too, is it loans money to foreign countries. Well, the reason it loans money to foreign countries, for instance, it made a big loan to Brazil.
Yeah.
But it made a big loan to Brazil so they could buy American stuff, okay? American manufactured goods. Brazil has a lot of trouble. A company in Brazil or the Brazilian government has a lot of trouble borrowing money because they're not exactly the most creditworthy nation on the planet. And they, for example, want to develop a bunch of oil off their coast in the Atlantic Ocean, and they need to have a lot of equipment to do that. And the deal is that we can offer, it's kind of like if you go down to the Ford dealership or the GM dealership or whatever, and you want to buy a car, in many cases they will offer you a very favorable loan from their in-house system. And that's basically what we're doing when people say we want to buy a bunch of oil equipment. Should we buy it from the Russians? Should we buy it from the British? Or should we buy it from you or from the French?
Here's a great one.
And the bank loans money to buy American goods that are manufactured in the United States, thereby providing a lot of jobs here.
Huge example. If Thailand is looking at buying airplanes for its commercial fleet. You know, it's Air Thailand. They want to fly people around.
Right.
They have two places really to go. They can go to France and Airbus, or they can go to Boeing in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
If they go to France, this is very much like what you do when you go to buy a car. You can buy these things with cash. Well, not everybody has the cash sitting in their coffers to go and buy a car completely with cash.
Or a fleet of large airplanes.
Right. A fleet of large airplanes most people don't have in their bank account. This includes countries. So when they go to France...
Unless their name is Warren Buffett.
Right. They have to negotiate with governmental banks and with private banks to put together a large group of loans to buy these airplanes. Or they can go to Boeing and put together one loan from the Export-Import Bank. We're not giving any subsidies to Boeing for selling abroad. It's equal trade. They're giving the same fully competitive deal that Airbus does. But if we don't have a system, and the Export-Import Bank is vastly profitable, I'll have you know, those loans get paid.
Well, they have a collection agency called the United States Armed Forces.
When an aircraft carrier shows up at your door, you're like, oh, I got to pay that loan, don't I? Sorry about that. So that concept, this is very, very much like the extending of the debt ceiling. It's a political move that the Congress is flexing its muscles, particularly the right side of Congress is flexing its muscles, saying, "Well, what do you do? What are you going to give us if we don't do if mm-hmm. we do this?"
Basically, they're saying, "We would love to blow up the export industry in the United States, and if you don't do something that we want, we'll blow up the export industry in the United States."
Now, they've offered to extend this timeline to June 30th. But there's a problem with that. If they
Of next year. Okay.
If they extend it, and there is no full bill to do this yet. If they extend it and there's a change, in Congress, and say there are more Republicans in the House and maybe close to a majority or a majority in the Senate, and they decide to keep using this as a tool, it could spell the demise as easily as them just not extending it.
It effectively, we have a recovering economy right now, and this is a very unusual economy recovery. Normally, an economic recovery from a major recession is led by home construction, and in this particular case, it's not. As a matter of fact, home construction right now is down compared with a year ago. By the way, I do have the stuff on that now. It's mortgage issuance and everything else is down from a year ago. So we're in a very weak recovery, and this particular recovery is being led by, you're going to get this, manufacturing exports mainly. If we shut down the Import-Export Bank,
or even just give it some shakiness, so that
if we make it questionable, we could easily wreck the recovery. And certainly wreck the manufacturing recovery. In the United States, we're gaining manufacturing jobs faster than we have in many, many, many years. And one of the big reasons is the Import-Export Bank.
Right. And to explain why the extension would be a bad thing, instead of just fully extending it, doing it just for a year, if we used the completely hypothetical example of Thailand again, this deal doesn't get made in a day. It isn't like driving by a car sales place and seeing a big pink gorilla on the roof and going, "Oh, I want to buy a car." The government of Thailand spends a lot of time thinking about this. The corporations involved in the purchase of these airplanes spend a lot of time thinking about this, and there's a lot of negotiations. And at the same time that they're negotiating with the United States, they're negotiating with France. If in the middle of this, we say, "We're going to get you a good loan from the Export-Import Bank, and the date on which they want to purchase is July 1st of 2015. The deal is broken."
Yeah, and very frankly, one of the keys here is that the manufacturing jobs that would be lost are probably 70% in states that have Democrats in their congressional representatives mainly, rather than Republicans. So the Republicans really would like to slam the blue states. Now, frankly, folks, that's really stupid. But it gets them a lot of votes.
Wait a minute. You're being redundant. We're being repetitive and redundant. We're talking about Congress, and you said stupid.
Very frankly,
repetitive.
The reason it's up and there's a lot of noise being made about it is there's a congressional election coming up, and they want to energize the right-wing conservative voters who believe the government shouldn't be loaning money to countries like Brazil so that Brazil can buy a lot of heavy construction and oil equipment from the United States.
Right.
And they just think it's completely wrong that the United States government is loaning money to Brazil
when we have to borrow money at home.
Right. And despite the fact that that particular institution is very profitable and actually pays money to the Treasury and reduces the deficit, which we got to do some commercials, Bill. Don't
confuse us with facts.
Let me end with this. The projected deficit for this fiscal year in the United States, which is, by the way, almost over, is $500 billion. Now, you're thinking, that's a lot of money. Well, it was $1.9 trillion in 2009. And just for the record, that's about four times the deficit we have today. What I'm trying to say to you is, You haven't heard much about the deficit lately, and the reason is it has come down 75% in 5 years and is still shrinking. The deficit after adjustment for inflation today, the dollar deficit for this fiscal year will be approximately the same that Ronald Reagan had.
Okay, do you have it as a percentage?
It's 2.9% of GDP.
Okay, we just had a GDP growth number that was revised.
Mm-hmm.
You familiar with this?
Right.
4.7%.
Yeah, so our economy is growing faster than our debt. That means that if your income is going up faster than your debt is going up, you're getting healthy.
This is a good thing. Even though we're growing the debt, we're growing the economy faster. So it's you can get a more expensive house and mortgage if your income goes up and you didn't just put your ratio out
right,
of
and
balance.
Throw another figure in there. Inflation is running, at least for this quarter, I don't know, last quarter, it's probably going to be flat for this quarter, but it's running about 2%.
Right.
So the real growth in the deficit would be 0.9%.
Yeah, 0.9%, and the GDP is already adjusted for inflation, and it's at 4.7.
So we are headed in a direction that definitely will pull down the debt levels of the United States.
I just wish,
at this point
in
time.
In many ways, I wish that the election had been last November instead of this November, because the economy is going to be looking really nice right before the elections. And that means that we may not get as big a change as I think is deserved.
But wait till 2016. We got to do some commercials. This is a commercial enterprise here at KTEM, and that means we have to let you listen to people who want to sell you things. So you want to listen to them really carefully, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and Jake
McClure.
Telephone number's in here in the last 5 minutes of the first hour. We have another hour coming up, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
Have you noticed how people are calling in today? Is it the cool weather?
I think it's just that we've been gone so long. They're finally, if we call them in, maybe they'll stay.
It might be.
I mean, we've been gone for... We missed 2 weeks of this program.
Did you notice that we went to war last week?
Where's war?
Well, wherever it was, we went to it last week. Because on one day, John Kerry said that this is definitely not a war against ISIS or ISIL, depending on
ISIL,
which.
ISIL, ISIS.
It is an extended terrorist, anti-terrorist activity, okay?
Okay. Next day.
The next day, the press secretary... And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said it was a war.
Oh.
So in one day, we had gone from being...
An extended terrorist anti-insurgency operation to...
Well, it wasn't anti-insurgency, just anti-terrorism.
Oh, okay. All right.
To war in one day. And, you know...
It doesn't seem like we
nobody,
did anything different.
But nobody in Congress said anything. There's a little clause in the Constitution.
Because you've got to declare war. I think that... Well,
yeah.
We still have a declaration of war...
We don't.
Against... We have a war on terrorism that happened.
Yeah, but we never
right
had a declaration
after September 11th.
We have never had. The president simply stated it. Congress never got around to declaring war. Anyway, we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning, Jeff and Jake. This is Bert and Colleen.
Hello, Bert and Colleen.
Hey, I have a question in reference to 401k. I'm maxing out my 401k, and my brother's asked me a question about because I was. Considering, like, should I open up a Roth IRA to put some more money into it? I'm really working from behind. I went through a pretty bad divorce, kind of wiped out some of my savings, so I'm trying to, you know, expedite some savings to, you know, for retirement stuff. Anyway, would a Roth IRA on top of my 401k be beneficial, and is there any kind of tax law that prevents me from doing that or anything?
As long as you have earned,
how much money you make.
Yeah, as long as you have earned income, you have the ability to put money away.
Okay,
If you don't make too much.
$150,000 a year, $150,000.
And you're single?
Are you single or married?
I'm single at this time.
Okay.
You're up on the limits there somewhere, pretty
I'm
close
gonna
to it.
I'm going
to
look that up.
He's going to look that up. Bottom line to it is there's a maximum amount of money that you can make while participating in an employer-sponsored plan, and still do a, let me back up a step, a deductible IRA. Now, that's not a Roth, but a deductible IRA. Ideally, and he's looking up the numbers, I think you're probably just under the limit. And if you are, my recommendation at a single person at $150,000 is probably using a regular IRA would be more advantageous than using a Roth. The Roth IRA works well if you expect to be in a higher taxable position in retirement than you are today.
Okay.
If you're going to be in a lower taxed position in retirement than you are today, and I can tell you, you almost certainly will be, then doing a tax deduction today to pay the taxes from a lower bracket in the future is probably smarter, okay? Because if you do a Roth, you pay the taxes and then you invest the money.
Right.
So what you're doing is said, I'd rather pay the higher taxes if you do a Roth at $150,000 for a single person, unless you have something going on we don't know anything about.
No.
And you're saying, I'd rather pay the higher taxes now and avoid the lower taxes later.
I see.
That's not generally. Now, a lot of people do that. Most people believe in buying high and selling low and paying their taxes at the highest. You know, that when people convert a, and we're almost out of time here, when people convert the IRA to a Roth, that's what they do.
Anyway, we're going to have to answer next hour.
We'll answer you next hour, okay?
This has been the Personal Wealth Coach. Thanks for listening.
KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America. News Radio 1400 KTEM.